Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. My guest today is Matthias Claesson, author of the book A Very Nervous Person's Guide to Horror Movies, published in 2021 by Oxford University Press. In our talk, we review his previous work related to horror and discuss various aspects of how people can overcome their concern about scary movies. We also review the various studies and surveys that helped him develop his ideas. I hope you enjoy my interview with Matthias Claesson. Hi, Matthias. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
The book is A Very Nervous Person's Guide to Horror Movies, and the author with me today is Matthias Claesson, and the book is going to come out from Oxford University Press. Before we talk in detail about the book, let's get a little bit of background about you. As you say right at the beginning of the book, you consider yourself to be a horror movie expert or horror. I don't remember now whether it was just movies or anything horror related, but you can talk about that. So I guess in order to be nice about it, but I still got to say it, what's wrong with you? No, I'm kidding. So if you give me a little bit of background about what led you in your life to decide that horror was going to be a topic that you were going to study.
Yeah, well, actually, that professional interest, so my research interest in horror, and that interest covers horror in all media. So horror movies, horror literature, horror video games, haunted attractions, and so on. But that professional interest actually springs out of personal fascination. But it wasn't always fascination for me. And I have these very distinct, vivid memories from my own childhood of being terrified by ghost stories, of watching horror movies that really scared me very, very badly. But I think even those overwhelming experiences with scary stories sparked an interest in me, made me think about the big why. You know, why do people do this stuff? Why do people spend time and money to be frightened witless by movies and books and so on? So I think I was probably in my teenage years when I started truly being truly positively engaging with horror, you know, getting actual pleasure out of watching horror movies and reading books by Stephen King and Edgar Allan Poe and Lovecraft and all the other greats.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't consider myself to be a horror fan, so to speak. I have seen plenty of horror movies, although I tend to go with older ones because, frankly, I don't like gore, and a lot of the newer movies seem to depend a great deal on that. You've been able to access Western horror films, so to speak, because your book pretty much just sticks to, and your most of the material you've written in the past is pretty much sticks to that type of horror film versus plenty all the other material that's out there from other countries. Is that right?
That's right. But that's partly because I work in an English department. So I have a kind of an obligation to focus on English language, literature and films. But it's also where my interest lies. I mean, that's the stuff that has always interested me. But there has never been an issue with availability, especially not in this globalized world. I mean, you can stream pretty much anything.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, because you even talk about it in the book. You mention The Haunting of Hill House from Netflix. So clearly, these days are probably the golden era for being able to get a hold of material from all kinds of eras, not even just current. I mean, older material is very easy to find. And if it's old enough, you can often find it without having to pay a cent for it. So if it's really old, like silent films and things like that.
That's right.
So where do you, you are currently and have been, I assume, for quite a while at, say it to me again. I know I asked you before. I want to make sure I get it right. It's Aarhus University, or is it University of Aarhus? Which way am I supposed to be?
Well, it used to be University of Aarhus, but now it's Aarhus University. So,
Aarhus.
Yeah.
And you've been there how long? And you're obviously, as you pointed out, you're in the English department, but I assume you're also able to do work within your field in your everyday life.
Yeah. So I've been at Aarhus University for a very long time. I enrolled as a student in the English department back in 2001, and then discovered during my studies that there was something here. You know, there was something I wanted to keep doing, studying literature, studying films. And then through a combination of stubbornness and luck, I was able to secure tenure. So I got my associate professorship 4 years ago. And I've been sticking around ever since. I've also been incredibly fortunate to collaborate with some very sharp scientists. And we can talk about some of those collaborations, but they have resulted in a big grant that allowed me to establish my own research lab, so that I'm now director of the Recreational Fear Lab, also at Aarhus University.
Yeah, that's one of the things about the book, and we'll get into it, is that you talk about horror, but you also bring in quite a bit of sociological, physiological, psychological aspects and studies. It's not, you know, it's definitely what we would call an academic approach, a scholarly approach to the topic, although obviously you include many of, you know, popular information. And you even say that right at the beginning, that you're hoping that this is a book that would reach across lines as far as what it includes. And this isn't your first book on the topic. What was your previous book was from 2017, and it was also related to horror. What was that book?
That's right. So I did a book in 2017 called Why Horror Seduces, also with Oxford University Press. But that was more of a classic academic monograph. I mean, right. I tried to make it sexy. I tried to make it approachable in terms of language and style. But that book is one long argument for approaching the academic study of horror in a specific way. So that's one of the things I've been working on for a long time, is trying to integrate biology and psychology into the study of horror. So that was basically the mission of Why Horror Seduces. I've also done a couple of books in Danish, but I don't think they would be as interesting to our listeners.
Well, we have worldwide, but I agree with you. Probably very overall, many of our listeners probably don't speak Danish. So, but I know you've done a lot of writing, and I also saw a number of your appearances. You've done all the kind. You're very wired into video and social media. So the good thing is, and I think you even mentioned it in the book, that you actually use some of that wiring to help you with some of your research that you've done for some of the studying for this book, where, as we've already said, you do a lot of material that is based off of research and other kinds of surveys and such. And we'll get into that in a second. And then, of course, you have a TED, it's TEDx, I guess is officially what you call it. There was a TEDx talk that I know is very well known, and that's great to see too. So there's plenty of information about you out there that people can go to if they want to learn more. So
yeah.
What was you, let's talk about the book now, obviously. What was your reasoning? As I've mentioned and we've talked about already, your book starts from a why question, obviously, is why do people watch horror films? And because obviously there are people out there who don't like, who will come right out and say they don't like horror films. And I'm going to be honest, I'm one of them. I don't think I've watched a current horror film in a while. Not that I don't want to. It's just, it's, I agree with you at the beginning. You said you don't really want to watch horror. You don't like watching horror films by yourself. But it's also the idea that I'm very picky about what I'm going to watch because I don't, as I mentioned earlier, I don't like gore. And unfortunately to me, many current horror films seem to be based on that more and more, but you can tell me more if I'm wrong on that. But so let's get into that a little bit. What kind of studying or what kind of surveying did you do to try to come up with your initial chapter where you talked about is what's the big deal and who watches them?
Right. Well, the idea for the book actually came from my editor at Oxford University Press, an incredibly nice and very smart guy called Norm Hershey. He asked me, say, why don't you do a book on horror movies directed at people who are interested in horror movies, but also kind of nervous about them? I thought that sounded like a great idea. And that's when I used my online network, as you said before. So I would ask on Twitter and on Facebook if people were nervous about horror, and if so, why? And I got a lot of very interesting responses. Lots of people telling me that they like horror movies, but they hate the jump scare. Or like you, they enjoy scary movies, but they really don't like the gore. Or they are afraid of having nightmares or flashback memories from the film. Or they're nervous about the moral structure of horror movies. And so I started collecting all of those responses and sorting them into categories. And that categorization of responses became the chapter organization of the book. So there is a chapter on who watches horror movies and why, a chapter on jump scares, psychological health, physical health, morality, kids and horror movies, those kinds of things. So that was really helpful for me to get an actual sample of actual concerns about horror movies, which I could then address in the book.
Yeah, because right at the beginning, you as I said before, you did a lot of work in compiling, but also reviewing other studies related to, as they say, sociological, psychological, and those kind of things. And of course, that becomes an important part. So even though there's a lot of information in this book related to your own research, but you also made sure to make the most of other studies that have ever been out there so that you try to draw it together as much as possible. Like I say, what's interesting is I've seen older horror films. I still remember I saw Exorcist when it came out. I saw Jaws when it came out, and Halloween when it came out. And a funny part about it is those films, I mean, I don't consider them to be similar to the kind of films now. So that's why, and as I said before, I could be completely wrong since I tend to avoid them, but that's what we're talking about, people who are nervous. So One of the things you talk about, and this is, as you pointed out, is the way things are set up. People, whether they watch horror films or not, but particularly if they don't, they have preconceived notions as to what horror films will do to you. And one of the things you do talk about is that you have a lot of studies to try to show when people were probably right about that and when they weren't. So let's talk a little bit about various aspects that you talk about in the book. And the first thing you talk about are jump scares, and that's what you call it. Other people have different names for it, but the concept should be pretty obvious. And that's when something happens unexpected and you're not prepared, or at least in theory are not prepared. And it's the thing that, jumps out at you, so to speak, and unexpectedly. It's a scary face, it's a monster, or anything else. So jump scares are obviously these days become the norm almost in horror films, I would think. When did you, in your discussion and your review of jump scares, do you feel like they've become the most important part in many ways of horror films, or the average horror film depends on jump scares, or are we still looking at filmmakers who are not always depending on that in order to get fear?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the answer is going to be a little bit complicated. But I thought jump scares were interesting because everybody has an opinion on jump scares. And most people that I've talked to feel that jump scares are a cheap trick that a horror movie maker can use if that movie maker doesn't have anything better to do, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Most people feel that horror movies that rely on atmosphere and suggestion and the gradual buildup of dread, that that's the real art, and that jump scares are just cheap tricks. But I hope to kind of, one of the things I hope to do with that chapter was to sort of redeem the jump scare, because some of the most effective jump scares in modern horror movie history are very tightly choreographed cinematic effects. And I see why they're perceived as cheap, because what a jump scare will do is that it will exploit a so-called startle response that is wired into human nature, but that we share with a bunch of other animals. So you can expose a cat to a jump scare, or a rat, or even, you know, you can make a tiny jump scare on a snail if you come across a snail. And those different species react in pretty much the same way. So it's a really very basic and evolutionarily ancient mechanism that protects us from sudden danger. And horror movies can take advantage of that mechanism by exposing us to some kind of sudden stimulus, usually a combination of an image and a loud sound. And it's true that I found some statistics that show that the jump scare has become more frequent in horror movies. So in the 1960s, there was on average, I think, about 2 jump scares per horror movie. Nowadays, it's more like 10 jump scares. And some movies have a lot of jump scares, like It, the recent movie based on Stephen King's classic novel. Mm-hmm. It's full of jump scares, and you're kind of a smoking wreck once you're done with that film, because it keeps just zapping your nervous system. But one thing I found it difficult to do in that chapter on jump scares was to provide any kind of advice on how to mitigate the unpleasantness of the jump scare. And that's because the startle response is so basic, you really can't control it, that there is very little you can do to avoid being jump scared, to avoid being shocked by a jump scare. Small amounts of alcohol seem to dampen the startle response a bit. And of course, the context in which you watch a horror movie also plays in. So there is a difference between sitting in a movie theater where it's dark and a huge screen and an awesome sound system and being jump scared, and then sitting at home in daylight watching something on a small screen. So for people who want to watch horror movies but don't want to be jump scared too bad, they should probably watch horror movies at home.
One of the things that you talk about early on, actually, and I meant to bring it up, but I think this is a good place to continue to talk about it, is what constitutes a horror movie? Because obviously there are some movies that aren't theoretically labeled horror movies, but they contain the elements of horror movies. And some of them are obviously horror movies. I consider Alien, for example, it's a horror movie. It's a haunted house film in space. Jaws is a horror movie, even though there's nothing supernatural. It doesn't have to be supernatural in order for it to be a horror movie. Now, people can disagree on different things, but I think in both of these cases, they share the jump scare. Both films have jump scares. And do you feel like, I mean, obviously other films have jump scares as well, non-horror movies. I guess what changes something from being a horror movie to being just suspenseful or a thriller that just happens to, for example, include jump scares?
Right. That's a really tough question. Actually, it's a question I've been trying to sidestep for my whole career. It came up in my PhD defense 9 years ago because I wasn't able to come up with a really good, solid definition. I just said, you know, horror movies are movies that are designed to scare the audience. But you're totally right. You can find the elements of horror in things that are obviously not horror. The jump scares, monsters, scenes that are anxiety inducing. So I guess it's really a matter of how much of that horror material is in a given movie. So it's perfectly conceivable to imagine a movie that's 90 minutes long and has a 2-minute horror scene, mm-hmm. but the rest is comedy or science fiction or something else. So I guess it's a matter of substance or frequency. And then, of course, there are hybrids like horror comedies, Gremlins, for example, a modern classic that has horror elements and comedic elements. And that spooked a lot of kids because many children went to see that film. So you know, it's very difficult to come up with a good definition, I think. And the borders between horror and neighboring genres like thriller and suspense films, those are very kind of porous borders. And actually, sometimes people will put the thriller label on a movie that is, to everybody else, obviously a horror movie. It happened with Silence of the Lambs. When it was nominated for an Oscar award, everybody was very eager to not call it a horror movie because there are certain prejudices associated with the horror genre. So it was labeled a thriller instead, which sounds more culturally acceptable, I guess.
Yeah, I think when you ask the average person, especially if they're not a horror expert or somebody who watches them regularly, they would probably say there has to be some sort of a supernatural element or a ghost or those kinds of things. But as we know, there are plenty of films that definitely count as horror but aren't in any way, shape, or form. They're all quote-unquote realistic, so to speak. Very little, if anything. When, as far as filmmakers who don't use jump scares that much, who would you think, in your own opinion, are particularly great horror filmmakers, but don't depend particularly on jump scares, or don't that much? Can you think of anybody that you would come up with that would you say is a great horror film director, but didn't really depend that much on jump scares?
Hitchcock comes to mind. Hitchcock did some horror movies like Psycho and The Birds, a lot of suspense movies as well. And he has the occasional jump scare. There is a very famous scene in Psycho involving a certain mother and a chair that gave a lot of people a jump scare. So that would be one example. I think one of my favorite horror movie directors is John Carpenter, who did Halloween and a bunch of other horror movies that are now considered classics. And he uses the occasional jump scare, but he relies much more on atmosphere and a kind of slow burn tension build to affect his audience. So those would be two examples.
Right. Actually, I think you pointed out quite well about Hitchcock, because Hitchcock tended to let you know in advance that something was coming. It's the infamous MacGuffin story, where there's got to be a reason, and the more if you know about it in advance, you're going to be more likely to be tension. The tension will go up because you know it's coming. And obviously, a Carpenter, to a large extent, went that way as well. As you say, Halloween doesn't really have many in the sense of jumping out, at least that you weren't expecting, because you know Michael Myers was around. It's just a matter, okay, when's he appearing? And so that wasn't completely surprising when it happens. And in fact, Halloween has absolutely no supernatural elements till the end. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, until they shoot, he gets shot and falls down and then suddenly disappears, it's really not supernatural. But you're right, it doesn't have and jump scares. Then I'm thinking of somebody like De Palma, where yes, he has jump scares, but there's tend to be ones that you're expecting, at least somewhat in the same way. The only the one example I can think of a true jump scare from De Palma, of course, was at the end of Carrie, where that is a pure jump scare. Anybody who's seen that movie and didn't know about that scene when it first came out always point to it as being, and yet it really didn't advance the plot in any way, shape, or form, and he didn't really have any jump scares in the rest of the film. So it was an interesting, you know, at the very end. I mean, he does it again a couple more times in later films, but it is an interesting concept of good horror that every once in a while they still have to throw the jump scare in.
It's like they can't help themselves, you know.
Right.
Like you almost see them wringing their hands and smiling in anticipatory pleasure at imagining this huge audience screaming.
I haven't watched the film in a long time, but every time I watch it, I still get scared by it, because even though I know it's coming, because it's so well done.
Exactly. And I think you mentioned Jaws before, and there is especially one famous jump scare involving a severed head underwater. Right. And Spielberg put a lot of effort into shooting and reshooting that scene. I think he ended up reshooting it in his own swimming pool because he wanted the timing to be just right. Mm-hmm. And then when the film was screened, and people, you know, they screamed and they ran out of the movie theater. And there was one guy, according to legend, who ran out of the movie theater and vomited and ran back in. And Spielberg saw this, and he said to himself, that's when he knew he had a hit on his hands.
Right.
And that was the jump scare scene that really worked.
But once again, there's only one or two other, there is one other one, and that's when Brody's throwing the chaw into the ocean, and suddenly the shark appears, and that was a jump scare, because nobody, you know, now you know it. Like you say, I think you mentioned this in the jump scares chapter, that you can start to, one way to get over jump scares is to understand when they're likely to come. And you give some examples of, okay, when it gets quiet or when this happens or this happens, that might tell you a jump's coming up. So be prepared.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about learning kind of the grammar of the horror movie. And once you get that grammar or syntax down, the basic structure or rhythm, you can start anticipating the jump scares. And that's one way in which you can steel yourself. It doesn't completely extinguish the startle response, but it can moderate it slightly.
So then the next two chapters deal with two aspects related to horror films. The first is mental health, and the second is physical health. And you give some examples. Let's start with the mental health chapter of people who, and I think your general point is people who already have some issues, particularly psychological issues, are likely to be affected, could be likely to be affected by horror films. But what about the average person? What was your take after doing your research on it?
Right. Yeah, so that was one concern that I've been coming across quite a lot, is that horror movies are potentially psychologically harmful, that they can damage people permanently. And I've come across a few articles in the scientific literature that talk about cinematic neurosis, which supposedly is when people are clinically traumatized by horror movies. But once I really dug into that that scientific field and that research literature, it became evident that those cases of people being truly psychologically harmed by horror movies are extremely rare. And it seems to always involve people with, as you say, pre-existing conditions. And so there are these instances in cinematic history where a horror movie will affect people very strongly, and rumors will start going about people suffering long-term trauma because of those movies. The Exorcist is one. Poltergeist had that reputation. Jaws had that reputation. Blair Witch Project. But it really, for people without serious psychological issues, there doesn't seem to be any real risk. It's not that you get traumatized. Horror movies do not cause post-traumatic stress disorder. They can cause nightmares, and they can cause you to, I mean, I still get a little bit antsy when I've seen a really scary movie and I have to take the dog for a walk and it's dark outside. Sure, I can feel my anxiety levels spiking, but that's to be expected. You know, that's the horror movie setting that whole fear system into action. But psychological trauma is not something people should be worried about.
Well, frankly, the only thing Blair Witch Project did for me was give me a headache. I saw it in the theater, and all the moving around, the camera movement was just, after a while, it just got it. Like I say, I can't put it any other way. It gave me a headache. And, you know, so as far as that's concerned, that was a physical part of it. But yeah. I guess my thought process is there's plenty of other films that are not horror films that can do the same thing, I would think. I mean, I still won't. I've only seen Saving Private Ryan maybe twice. And not because of the opening. It's more the scene later, towards the end when the one American soldier gets killed by the German with his knife. I mean, that scene just completely grosses. Even though there's no gore, that scene just completely. I can't watch that film because of that scene. I just don't want to see it again. So right. I would think that that's where a big difference would be, that if horror films can do it, so can other films.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
So the physical health, it's obviously similarly related. I would think that somebody who has physical ailments already might have issues. I mean, we've heard the stories of people being scared to death, so to speak, or having heart attacks. Mm-hmm. Is it something, has there been any studies to indicate that, you know, somebody could literally die unless they already had a physical condition that was up, you know, going on, an ongoing condition?
No. I mean, I did find a few cases of what appears to be people dying from fright because of horror movies, but they're sketchy and they're poorly described and they're usually journalistic reports. So no kind of scientific investigation. A normal, healthy person could not die from watching a horror movie. I mean, there are a bunch of predictable and expected physiological effects. I mean, you can expect your heart rate to increase. You can expect to get sweaty palms. Your hairs might stand on end, all those kinds of things. But it's not the case that your heart is going to stop from fright. It could be in the future that somebody develops maybe not a horror movie, maybe a horror virtual reality simulation that is sufficiently scary to kill off somebody, at least somebody with a heart condition. But I don't think unless you have such a condition, you shouldn't be worried.
And then we can move on to the morality aspects, which makes sense. I mean, there is no question, but it's not just, once again, we keep saying this, but I'm going to keep mentioning it because it's true. Morality in film doesn't necessarily just mean horror films. Obviously there are people who believe things like the Harry Potter films and the books aren't good because they feel like it, you know, allows for witchcraft, so to speak, which they think is immoral. So, horror films, obviously depending on the situations could have morality issues, but what was your review, what did you find as far as where people avoid horror films because of the morality issues? Or is that more just one of those things people say that turn out not really to be the case?
Yeah, I think it's a common concern that horror movies aren't only psychologically harmful, they are morally corrosive, that they will either appeal to immoral people or erode the viewer's morals. But those kinds of claims usually come from people who don't really know anything about horror movies, because most horror movies are actually very moral. They usually have a very strong moral structure. There are horror movies that I find unpleasant to watch and that rub against my own sense of morality, but that's very rare. But I think that the real concern here is that that people will be infected with the perceived immorality of horror movies. That if young people, for example, watch a lot of slasher movies, they will adopt the lack of morality that they see on the part of the slasher villain. But there is no science to support such an idea. People aren't passive receptacles of movies. A lot of studies have shown that when people watch movies, they're actively and also often critically engaged. They resist what they watch. They process it. They engage with it. And there is a parallel here, I think, in those recurring discussions about violent movies and aggression. where a going concern is that if you watch many violent movies, you will become a more violent person. But again, that's not the case. People don't become violent from watching violent movies. And most people are good, nonviolent, pro-social citizens who can find pleasure in watching what they know to be fictional depictions of violence. I mean, I enjoy watching Bruce Willis kick the ass of bad guys as much as, you know, the next dude. It doesn't turn me into a violent aggressor. So that was one concern that I think I was able to hopefully put to rest.
Well, and I would think, as somebody who, like I say, reads Stephen King and certain other horror authors, what I always feel is I'm rooting for the good guy. Generally yeah. speaking, horror films tend to go with the good versus bad pretty obviously. As most of these cases, you know who the positive person, who the good people are, and you know who the bad people are, or bad spirits, or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And horror movies, from my experience, tend to be pretty obvious that way. Every once in a while, you might get a villain who has... And for some reason, vampires tend to be that way, where for some reason in many vampire films, there is a certain amount of desire to make the vampire at least real, you know, personable or having some sort of positives, or, you know, that people might be interested in. They're usually handsome, or if they're women, beautiful, and those kind of things. But most other films that I've seen, it's pretty obvious the good versus bad.
I think that's exactly right. There is often a very kind of black and white morality in horror movies. I mean, it's clear to everybody who you're supposed to root for in The Exorcist and who you're supposed to not root for. Same in every major horror movie example that comes to mind. And of course, there is a certain appeal in the anti-hero and the morally complicated protagonist. I mean, that's something that's maybe especially recently become more and more popular in shows like Dexter or Sopranos or Mad Men or Breaking Bad. So again, those are not horror shows. Mm-hmm. And maybe there are fewer kind of morally complicated characters in horror than in other genres, which in itself would be very interesting.
You see it more, like I say, I think in literature. Horror literature tends to be more rich as far as the characters, but that's sometimes part of it. The good horror films shouldn't be very long. I mean, I know you mentioned 90 minutes, and frankly, these days, it seems like more and more films, or all kinds of films, not just horror, are reaching past that two-hour mark. It used to be you never went past 2 hours. But in the day of multiplexes, they can show the movie so many different times. It's not like the old days where you only had one or two screens and you couldn't afford to show a movie, a 3-hour movie or a 2.5-hour movie regularly because there wasn't enough time. But nowadays, this is totally unrelated to what we're talking about, but still horror movie related. Do you have particular thoughts about movie lengths and their value or lack of value to horror?
Not really. That's not something I've thought about or studied. But it does seem to be the case, certainly, that horror movies get longer and longer. There might be a kind of counter movement because I think some of the independent productions that are... I mean, it's a really good time now to be a horror fan because there are so many good horror movies coming out from studios like Blumhouse and A24 and a bunch of American studios. And those movies tend not to be very long. But sometimes, I mean, the It movies were much too long for me. I know that the novel, you know, I taught Stephen King's It a couple of years ago. I actually asked my students to read a 1,400-page novel in 2 weeks. Hmm. And they did because it's an awesome novel.
Right.
And I can see the issues with turning that into a feature film. But I still thought they overstayed their welcome a little bit.
Yeah, at least The Stand, it's come out twice now. In both cases, it was miniseries. And the good thing is that is a novel and that to a large extent, the positives and negatives of both the good guys and the bad guys come out. I mean, none of the characters are what we would consider to be pure one way or the other, or most of them aren't. So it becomes pretty obvious the way they made them, both of them, both the original miniseries and then the later one, were able, because they went longer, to take advantage of that in order to make characters real characters as opposed to the good versus bad. Oh, even though in the end, the movie, the whole story, the whole book and the films are good versus evil. That is the key to the whole thing.
It is, but it's still, I think you're right that these metaphysical forces of good and evil, they attract, they both have their peculiar attractions. And some of the most interesting characters in The Stand are torn between those two forces, like Harold Lauder, for example, right, who of course goes over to the dark side. But that actually, the old miniseries, Mick Garris's The Stand, that was what really turned me on to horror almost, what is it, 25 years ago.
Right.
And then I read The Stand by Stephen King, and then I read everything by Stephen King. And then I went back and read everything that had inspired Stephen King. So I owe my career to Stephen King, is how I like to think of it.
Yeah, I still remember reading, and I, even though it's an older book, quite an older book now, Dance Macabre, the one nonfiction book he wrote on horror. I mean, that's where so much of what I feel about horror and movies that he's mentioned, that back in the day when that book came out, that was pre-video. So to see some of those films that he talked about in there were very difficult to do. And in fact, the whole last section is about how he wrote The Stand. But one of the things he always talked about was the different levels of horror, and then how filmmakers sometimes go for the most cerebral type of horror, and then sometimes the more scare, and then finally just the gross out if they have to. So he created what I thought was a very good way of looking at horror films. So that's a good thing.
And I think if your listeners only have money to buy one book, they shouldn't buy my book. They should buy Dance Macabre. It's really good.
Yeah. And like I said before, that was one of those film books that I wish he would update. I wish he would write a new version of it. I know he's putting out his one and two books a year, which is fine, and they're great. It's just that was, I always find his nonfiction writings to be interesting because of things like that, because he comes up with ideas that make perfect sense. It's just he writes them down in a way that makes them interesting.
Yeah, so, I agree.
So then we talked about morality, but the next chapter then discusses the idea of intelligence, and people who aren't intelligent are more likely to watch horror films. That's the idea, is that supposedly people think that you have to be a little lower in intelligence to watch horror films. And I think we've pretty well already taken care of that in many ways. But do people in reviewing, do you have people who sort of don't want to admit that they watch horror films because they're afraid it'll make them look less intelligent?
Yeah, I come across that fairly often. Again, one of these biases or prejudices that people who like horror are unsophisticated or dumb or unpolished, uncultured. And there are some studies that find that there is a slight correlation between, actually a negative correlation between educational attainment and horror preference, which is to say that horror fans, statistically speaking, on average, tend to be slightly less educated than non-fans. I don't think that says anything about intelligence. I think it says something about prejudice. I think if you have a very long education and you work, like I do in a university, you will be surrounded by a lot of snobs who look down on horror, and you might be unwilling to admit that you enjoy being scared by movies about zombies and serial killers and masks and so on. But the thing is, it could be that this prejudice has to do with the fact that horror movies target what seems to be primitive emotions, you know, fear, anxiety, disgust, those kinds of emotions. But for one thing, I don't see what the problem is. I mean, most people expect to be emotionally moved by movies, no matter what genre. You want your emotions to be brought to life. You want to laugh or cry or scream. And secondly, the best horror movies don't just appeal to emotions, they appeal to the intellect as well. I mean, there are very clever horror movies out there. They also appeal to the aesthetic senses. I mean, you can watch a really good horror movie and marvel at the way in which it's made, marvel at a certain shot composition or the mise-en-scène in a particular scene or the acting. That's another unfortunate prejudice that horror and horror fans suffer under.
I think also, to me, it depends also on the films. I mean, we know that, at least in the United States, Hollywood uses a pretty tried and true method of when they bring out some of the horror films. It's usually right after a major season. So, for example, not unusual in September we see a lot of horror films. Not unusual in January we see a lot of horror films because they've brought out their blockbusters. Now they have to try to still keep people in the theater, and so they'll bring out some of the worst horror films in the world just to get people into the theaters. And I think when you look at horror films, to put them all into the same camp and say they're all bad, you must be stupid to watch any of them, is pretty bad, given that, as you point out, some of the greatest directors and writers have continued to write in the horror genre, and we continue to get good horror films coming out, not just what we would call the to use an English word, schlock, although it's probably Yiddish, so the bad stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think that life is too short for bad horror movies. And I do think there are more bad horror movies out there than there are good horror movies. So the trick really is to find the good ones and spend your time on those. But that's no different from any other genre. And it's no different from any other medium. I mean, there's plenty of bad literature out there. So don't waste your life on that.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you a quick question it's on the topic of horror. When you think of horror, older horror films, obviously I consider you to be obvious an expert in horror. What would you consider to be some great examples, and let's go pre-Exorcist, of great horror films that the average person who might not necessarily know of them or haven't seen them, especially a listener who has some fear of horror, but that you think might be great to watch just to get people more into horror without having to worry as much about the most obvious types of method horror film methods that we have these days?
Right. Well, horror, of course, goes back to the first days of cinema. I mean, that's one thing that interests me about horror, is that whenever humanity invents a new medium, they start making horror for that medium. That goes for virtual reality, computer games, movies, and so on. So there are many very early horror movies, but I think they would probably bore most people. I know my film historian colleagues would probably hunt me down and slice open my veins and drink my blood if they heard me saying this, but I wouldn't encourage most listeners to seek out the German silent movie Nosferatu from 1922, for example. But I think once we move into the 1930s with the monster movies from Universal Studios like Dracula and Frankenstein, they have qualities that I think would appeal even to modern viewers. They're usually based on literary works, and they're made at a time when the conventions of Hollywood filmmaking have begun to crystallize. So they don't seem so alien, so foreign. They're generally suspenseful, generally interesting. Another suggestion might be to look to the so-called Hammer horror movies of that's pre or post Second World War. Some stunning Dracula movies, for example, that would, I think, also interest people. So those would be some recommendations. And of course, we talked about Hitchcock, Psycho, Night of the Living Dead, groundbreaking zombie movie from 1968 or 9. Mm-hmm. It's in black and white by George Romero. But that I think that would be a good horror movie to watch, because it's not just about grossing people out. It's not just about scaring people. It actually it has a message. It has a lot of heart, but it's also very bleak, very disturbing.
Right. Yeah, that's the point I think that you've been making it consistently. The good horror films are the ones that have messages to them, even if the message, sometimes the message isn't as obvious. Sometimes they hit you right on the head with the message. But we think of the sequel to Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, which, of course, is much gross. It's in color and suddenly it's got a lot of gross parts in it. But the concepts and the ideas of the zombies walking through a shopping mall is just is pretty obvious. But still, it's an interesting way of looking at back at the time that movie came out, consumer society, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I wanted to mention that while we were thinking, while I was thinking of it, because we're sort of right in the middle of that, especially the stupid part. Because I said, there's like you've already said, there's plenty of smart horror films out there. It's sometimes just a matter of knowing what they are. We talked a little bit also about kids already when we talked about the morality part and some of the other ones, but I'm assuming, just like many of the rest of the chapters, you were able to find some studies or some information that gave you some sense related to children and horror. And then I think we all, the average person, I'm sure, would agree that a horror film, while some of them might be okay for kids, or, you know, depending on their ages, there's still a need to be careful just because they're kids.
Yes. And I did find a lot of studies, especially from media psychologists, who took a lot of interest in the effects of scary movies on kids back in the 1980s, probably because of some well-publicized horror movie releases like Gremlins. Now, Gremlins was, I think it was allowed for kids over the age of 7 in the U.S., but it's a really dark, I mean, I rewatched it with my own kids a couple of years ago, and I was surprised at how dark and scary some parts of Gremlins are. And so the whole controversy over the rating of Gremlins actually led to the PG-13 classification being introduced in the American film classification system.
As did Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. That was another one where, even though that wasn't a horror film, there were definite horrific elements, including scenes of child abuse and such. That most people say this in the United States, is that certain directors can get away with a lot more in their films than other directors can. And Spielberg's always been one of those folks. Poltergeist was rated PG, and yet it's definitely not what I would consider to be a PG movie for the frightness part of it. So, but I agree with you that there is no question that kids, it's still a matter of the guardian making sure that they have a sense. And like you say, don't let the kids watch them by themselves.
Yeah. That's one of the take home messages of that chapter, is that horror movies can do bad things to kids. I mean, they can put images into the kids' minds that shouldn't be there. They can cause sleep disturbances, mild behavioral disturbances. But there is also an element here of figuring out how best to protect kids. And it may not be the case that the best way to protect kids is to keep them from scary movies, because eventually they will watch a scary movie. And if they don't know how to approach a scary movie as a movie, if they have never seen a horror movie, they might be overwhelmed. They will not be able to predict the jump scares. They will have a hard time reminding themselves that it's just fiction and illusions and special effects. And so my advice to anybody who is concerned about kids watching horror movies would be, first off, don't let them watch, you know, adult horror movies. But secondly, help them ease into the, you know, fascinating universe of scary stories. Find something that is age appropriate, because there are horror movies for kids.
And horror books and such. I mean, there's literature, horror literature. Maybe start with something like that, where theoretically it's much easier for a child to put it down if they're getting scared. You know, just walk away from the book. But also, you know, that the Goosebumps series was meant to be exactly that.
Yeah, and I think they work to that purpose. So that would be a good thing, I think. But the whole, I mean, this is something I've become increasingly interested in, this whole issue of kids and scary entertainment, since I wrote the book, because I finished it like a year ago. I think it just takes a long time for the whole process to finish. So my group and I have been doing some research on recreational fear and kids. We did a pilot study. Actually, two of our lab interns did a pilot study in Danish daycare institutions in the spring to figure out whether the teachers in nurseries and kindergartens scared the kids on purpose. And we thought, we're not going to find anything. Turns out we found a lot. You know, those kids are constantly being frightened with scary stories, mildly scary stories, different activities where the grown-ups will pretend to be a monster and chase the kids around. They have different songs that have scary elements. And the teachers see it as part of their duty to help the kids train their emotion regulation skills. The kids need to learn what it feels like to be afraid, and they need to be able to regulate their own fear, because that's a skill that we all need in life. And one way in which you can train that skill is to expose yourself to scary stories. So this is something that I've become really interested in, the positive effects of horror on kids. Again, we're not talking, you know, The Exorcist in kindergartens. We're talking age appropriate stuff.
Yeah, I think your point at the very beginning of the book is a little bit of fear is not a bad thing. It's nothing wrong with that. I think the other thing is related to it is that kids have always been scared as part of their upbringing. I mean, stranger danger and all these kinds of things. I mean, you're basically telling a kid that anybody they don't know could theoretically be somebody that's going to hurt them. And those are the kind, and even around the house, parents teach kids different ways to be careful. And often it's based on fear, as you pointed out.
I think so. And I think even historically, cautionary tales can be seen as a kind of ancestor of the modern day horror film. You know, the kinds of stories you would tell kids 200 years ago or 1,000 years ago about what would happen if they strayed from the path in the woods or failed to live up to certain moral standards of the community. And those stories are very often horror stories.
So as you start to get to the end of the book, then the next section, and this is good, probably as good a place as any to sort of get into a sum up routine, and that's society. One of the things I've always wondered, maybe I've read it in the past, or I'm just not sure, is that are there indications that horror as a genre in film goes up and down depending on the way society is working? Like right now, we're in the middle of a pandemic that we thought was hopefully coming to an end, but didn't. This last year and a half has been incredibly stressful for people. And then the 30s, when some of the earliest monster movies came out, was right in the middle of the Depression. But then there are other times where theoretically society's going reasonably well. Do we see as much horror during those? Or is it something that tends to focus more on times where things aren't necessarily as good?
Yeah, that's a little difficult to say. I think all horror scholars would agree that horror movies are symptomatic of their societal historical context. So they reflect certain things in society, and they certainly go up and down. And in the last year, I mean, 2020 was one of the best years for horror ever, which is on the face of it paradoxical, because why would you want to be scared by a movie if you're finding existence itself to be scary? But that points to, I think, a potential kind of therapeutic potential of or ability of horror movies, that they can help us confront anxiety, but in a kind of contained, controllable, safe context. So I do think that times of crisis are maybe especially conducive to horror movies. I mean, they provide good soil in which horror movies can grow. But even times of, I mean, Denmark is one of the most peaceful countries on the planet. Danish people are among the most happy people of the planet. And horror is doing pretty well here. So it's complicated, and it's hard to say which kind of social or cultural context is more conducive to horror. But it's certainly the case that times of crisis do seem to be nourishing of scary movies.
So then in the end, you basically have, you've presented your information to the reader, and now you're, you know, you're finally getting to the point of saying to somebody, okay, they want to know, okay, what should I do then? If I'm really ready, and then you give some ideas, which we don't need to go into great detail, because I think most of your points are pretty well made, including going all the way back to the beginning of the book, which is maybe if it's your first horror film, you don't watch it by yourself or you watch it at home. But based on what your research has done, what would you, you know, how do you tell somebody that you should try horror films? And do you give specific suggestions to particular films, or is it more of a matter of telling people what to be, what to expect and be prepared for?
It depends on who's asking and what exactly they're asking. I give a lot of lectures to, you know, public lectures, and people who would never watch a horror movie sometimes show up because they're interested in why other people are fascinated by those movies. And sometimes they will ask me those kinds of questions. And I usually tell them what to avoid, like those, you know, gory, high jump scare frequency horror movies. And then suggest one or two horror movies that are clever and well-made and so on. But that's mainly for people who have an impoverished understanding of what horror movies are. And of course, those pieces of advice that you mentioned before, you know, think about the context in which you're watching the movie. Be very aware of sound levels and lighting in the surroundings. Watch it with people you trust and like. And to people who are very nervous, I would usually recommend that they watch older horror movies, because it's easier to distance yourself from an older horror movie than from a very recent one, because psychologically the distance between yourself and what is depicted in the movie is greater. People will be watching, you know, old-fashioned clothes in the movie. They will maybe use quaint old-fashioned slang. And so it's easier to remind yourself, this is just an old movie that's trying to scare me. So that's, you know, another piece of advice. Just watch old horror movies.
Well, as I say, I think the book does a great job of trying to lay out horror in a scholarly way, but as I mentioned before, but also in a way that hopefully there's information here that helps to give people things to think about, especially if they're, as the title says, nervous person. And you say there's nothing wrong with that sometimes, but obviously you're continuing to do your research, and since that is your life's research, it's an interesting idea, as you mentioned at the beginning. Are you working on other studies, or are you just continuing to compile, or where are your thoughts? Has Oxford University Press pushed you to in other directions to come up with other ideas related to horror?
They haven't pushed yet, but my group and I are pursuing several, we're doing several studies at the moment. We're continuing to do haunted house studies where we collect data from
the live
commercial
ones where people walk through them. Got it.
Exactly. Because those are high intensity attractions, and we can get some really interesting physiological and behavioral data on what happens when people are really scared, but also enjoying it. So we're doing some of those studies. We're
got about
looking
a month
into
or so before it becomes the time of the year to be prepared for it.
Exactly. The month of Halloween, that's when it really hits the high gear. But also some studies, we're designing some studies to get a better understanding of the social dynamics of horror. I mean, what are the social benefits of watching horror movies together? Does it bring people closer to one another? We're looking into the different kinds of horror fans that might exist. It looks like some people watch horror movies for the adrenaline, but other people watch them to learn about the world and themselves. So really, we have a bunch of studies lined up. We're just waiting for the world to become more normal so we can get back into the lab and collect data.
Well, it's been great talking to you. I've been speaking with Matthias Claesson, the author of the book, A Very Nervous Person's Guide to Horror Movies. And as I say, the book is scheduled to come out in the next month or so based on when we're recording. So keep an eye out for it. Oxford University Press. It'll be available in all the regular formats, and hopefully people will definitely look at it as a book that has a lot of interesting information. I particularly, like I said before, liked the scientific sociological bent you took, because I think it's an interesting way to look at movies in general and in this particular genre. So I really appreciate the time, and I hope things go well with the book.
Thanks very much, Joel. I've enjoyed talking with you.
My thanks to Matthias. If you aren't a fan of horror movies, I hope his book gives you a new way to view them. If you are a fan, I think you will enjoy his points. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.